Introduction to Luke. Luke 1:1 through 1:4. The first talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 7, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This morning I want to begin a new series on the Gospel according to Luke. I figured if I had done Acts, then I might as well do Luke, which is volume one of his work in the New Testament. It hadn't occurred to me until I was reading some comments about Luke that in terms of words, Luke writes more, I guess it depends on whether you count Hebrews as Paul's or not, but if you don't count Hebrews as Paul's, Luke writes more of the New Testament than any other author. That was pretty amazing. We don't know much about Luke. There's debate as to whether he was Greek or Jewish. Probably he was a Gentile, a Greek Gentile. Some theories have him coming from Macedonia. I'm not sure on what basis they decide that, but decide that he was a Macedonian who lived in Antioch, may have been trained in Tarsus. I don't know where all this information comes from, but basically we don't know a whole lot about him other than the only direct information we have is what we can glean from a handful of comments in Paul's epistles and his writings itself. So we do know that he was a doctor because Paul calls him a physician. He was that probably very well educated. His Greek is pretty educated Greek. And we know that he was a companion of the Apostle Paul in much of his journeys. So probably the one theory is that the Gospel of Luke was written while Paul was imprisoned in Caesarea in Palestine, and Luke had a little time on his hands and took the opportunity there to compile what we now know as the Gospel of Luke. The interesting thing about Caesarea is that from Caesarea, he'd be within walking distance, a relatively short travel time, to some of the principal characters to be able to go and interview them and investigate these stories directly. And I do think that there's evidence in the Gospel of Luke that much of the Gospel of Luke is based on eyewitness testimony, that he's gone and interviewed the people themselves, for example, Mary. I think it's highly likely that he interviewed Mary and his account of Mary and the announcement of the angel and so on is probably due to her own eyewitness testimony about what happened. What I want to do this morning is look at what I call the preface of the gospel. It's the only gospel that really has a preface kind of like this. John has a preface of a different nature, a theological preface. But Luke has a preface explaining why he's writing, why he's doing what he's doing, why he's taken on this project. And that's what I want to look at this morning. I am going to be, much to my wife's annoyance, I'm going to be reading from my translation. It didn't seem appropriate to reproduce this like I did 1 John because I don't think it's necessary. It follows closely enough any translation that you might have. I am reformatting it and doing the same thing that I did with 1 John, and I will be working from that, but I think you'll be able to use any English translation and follow along just fine. So the preface consists of the first four verses of chapter 1 of Luke. In view of the fact that many have undertaken to lay out a chronicle of those events that are fully accepted among us, just as those who were eyewitnesses from the beginning and who became servants of this story passed it down to us, it occurred to me, having investigated everything carefully from the start, to write it down for you in sequence, most excellent God lover, so that you might know the reliability of the stories you were told. Now let me just comment on three significant departures in my translation from what might be before you. First of all, the title, I translate it, Most Excellent God Lover. We'll talk more about this in a little bit, but your translation probably has Theophilus, a name. They're treating it as an individual person. I'm going to argue that I, although that's entirely possible, I am more inclined to go with it being a title that he's using for his reader, who he takes to be somebody who loves God. And so it's for the person who loves God that he's laying out this account in order that they might have a reliable account of what happened. So I've actually translated Theophilus rather than leave it alone as a name. Another thing that you might notice, the New American Standard ends that section with, so that you might know something like the exact truth of the, can't remember how they translate it, but the exact truth of these stories. And I translated it that you might know the reliability of the stories. That's going to be an important distinction as we go here, that the Greek doesn't actually have any word that corresponds to exact here. The word is used in context where it has nothing to do with truth at all. It's just when something is steady and firm and supportive, is able to support you. And so I've translated that reliability, because I think that's the idea. He wants his reader to know, that to have accounts that are accurate enough that they can be reliable to base your faith on. And we'll talk more about that before we're done. And then the third place where you'll notice a difference is the New American Standard says, many have undertaken to lay out a chronicle of those events that are accomplished among us, or something like that. Again, the word is, I mean, I'm not sure why they translated accomplished, because it seems to me that the idea in that word is to be that which has been firmly established as a part of the tradition and fully accepted and fully granted veracity by the community, as he says, among us. And we'll talk more about this later, but I think Luke's point is that there's a certain body of knowledge that we share, that we accept, and that we know is true. And Luke's purpose is to record that. That verb, I think, is capturing that idea, that which has been fully accepted among us, that's what he wants to record. Again, we'll revisit that before we're done. Okay, so first thing we notice is that he says, in view of the fact that many have undertaken to lay out a chronicle of those events that are fully accepted among us. Many, he says, have undertaken that. Well, he says, in view of that fact, it occurred to me to write it down for you that you might know. Now, it might, on the surface, if we don't think about it too carefully here, it might seem like what Luke is saying is, since many have undertaken to do this, and I'm kind of dubious about the accuracy of their accounts, let me set the record straight. Let me correct those accounts. But I think if we look closely enough at what he's saying here, that's really not what he's saying at all. Because it's not an issue of, those many others have undertaken to lay out an account of the things fully accepted among us. I don't think he's challenging the veracity of those accounts at all, because they're simply doing exactly the same thing that Luke is setting out to do, to lay out those things that we already know are true. So, rather, I think that the reason he says, in view of the fact that many have done that, it occurred to me to do that for you, I think he means I have a wealth of information. I have a wealth of resources from which to draw. And in view of the fact that those resources are out there, I'm going to take advantage of those resources. And having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, he says, I'm going to lay out for you sequentially what it is that I have uncovered. So I don't think he's correcting those. I think he's going to rely on those. Well, what are those others that have produced the chronicles? Back 100 or more years ago, there was developed what was called the documentary hypothesis. The Bible scholars, New Testament scholars, noticed that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, unlike John seems to be distinctive from the other three Gospels, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke share a whole lot of information in common. They go over the same ground in their own way, in their own words, but the same accounts, the same similar renditions, oftentimes exact phrases repeated. There's just closely parallel to one another. And that's why they are called the Synoptic Gospels. And I don't now remember what synoptic means, but that's where the word Synoptic Gospels comes from, that you can lay them in parallel and notice the parallels between them. The documentary hypothesis was noticing that Matthew and Luke appear to pretty much replicate the Gospel of Mark. There's very little in Mark that doesn't get reproduced in Matthew and Luke. Matthew and Luke, in turn, include a bunch of material in it that is not in Mark, but they share in common. And then Matthew has some material that's unique to him, and Luke has some material that's unique to him. Now, I haven't actually done that work myself, so I don't know how firmly established that really is. It hasn't interested me that much. But because of that described phenomenon, the documentary hypothesis was that Matthew and Luke relied upon Mark. They took Mark as a kind of template for doing their work, had other resources at their disposal, and the theory that developed was that there was a document that they called Q for the German word Quelle, which means source, that there was this document that they called Q that Matthew was also relying upon and that Luke was also relying upon, and then perhaps other documents used only by Luke and other documents used only by Matthew. And that's called the documentary hypothesis. Whether the exact details of that hypothesis are right or not, Luke is right up front about the fact that he is going to rely upon literary sources, it seems to me. Others have written accounts of these things, and so it occurred to me to do likewise. And again, I think the most straightforward way to read that is because they are providing me resources that I can use to accomplish this. So he's as much as acknowledging that he's going to depend upon and rely upon those resources. What was the purpose of all these chronicles of Jesus' deeds and his teaching? I think this is going to be the purpose of Luke's gospel, and I think Luke is telling us that it was the purpose of those other accounts that he's relying upon as well. He seems to say, I want you to know, to have a reliable account of the things that Jesus said and did. So apparently, we're at a point in history, as Luke writes this account and as the others have begun to write this account, we're at a point in the history of the development of the church where it becomes clear to them that the informal process by which the truth of what Jesus said and did could simply be passed back and forth informally was not going to work on the long term. And I think we saw when we were looking at 1 John how right they were in their farsightedness, in their foresight there. Because as we looked at 1 John, remember, the whole letter was written against a situation where teachers had come into these churches in Asia and were beginning to purport to speak for Jesus and give you the straight scoop on what Jesus said and who Jesus was and who he claimed to be and what he was all about, that was radically different than what the apostles claimed. And John is writing to a second generation of believers who are in a position where they have to either take the word of their parents or take the word of these teachers who are claiming authority, who are claiming credentials, who are undoubtedly very powerful and charismatic kinds of people, something that parents can never be. And they were having to make a choice between, you know, these stodgy old-timers in our church who are telling us what the apostles taught us and these flashy newcomers who are claiming the credentials of being disciples of Jesus himself. Well, and John is in a position to set the record straight, but as I would understand 1 John, John may be the only apostle left when he's writing that letter. This is going to be the last time in history when a church can say, we're a little confused here. We don't, Could somebody who was actually with Jesus set the record straight here? Once John is dead, who's going to do that? Who's going to set the record straight? There's no longer an eyewitness from the beginning who became a servant of this story around to ask. So Luke and others began to realize that we're going to have to put into some kind of historical concrete what all of us already know, what all of us are already in a position to be able to use as a standard for judging spurious, exaggerated, inaccurate accounts, judging them so, and embracing only that which we all know is true. So in order to put that into historical concrete, they decide we need to write this down and have it there for the next generation. There's no indication here that Luke is really thinking way downstream, long range. I don't think he had us in mind as he's writing the Gospel of Luke. I think he just had the next couple generations in mind when he's writing the Gospel of Luke. And little did he know how valuable what he was doing would be to generation after generation after generation, I think. Okay, let me emphasize something here. So their purpose is to preserve the account of Jesus' deed and teaching, in Luke's words, as that was handed down to us by those who are eyewitnesses from the beginning who became servants of this story. He primarily has in mind the apostles. That is to say, I want to preserve the account that the apostles have given to us of what Jesus said, what he taught, and what he did. So that's what he's wanting to preserve. The source of information is not always an apostle per se. We have information that comes from Zacharias. We have information that comes from Elizabeth here just in the first chapter. We have information that comes from Mary. So the information, the eyewitnesses of this thing are sometimes not apostles. But I think what Luke is hinting at here is that there is this, through this informal process, there has developed this body of stories, this body of accounts that has been vetted by the apostles. I mean, they've taken a look at this and have judged it as authentic or inauthentic, as true or not true, based on whether or not it coheres with what they, as eyewitnesses of Jesus' life and teaching, do understand to be who Jesus was, what he was up to, what he was about, and so on. So all of this has the stamp of the apostolic authority on it, ultimately, because I think they are ultimately the ones who have provided the criteria and the standards for judging what is an authentic tradition and what is not an authentic tradition here. And understand what I mean by tradition. I don't mean what we traditionally mean by tradition, something that goes on generation after generation. This is still all taking place within the context of their lifetime. You know, they're always around. They're still alive when Luke is writing this thing. So this has not been passed through several different hands. So what seems to be in the background of what Luke is saying here is the fact that there is this informal, self-correcting, and self-monitoring process that gave rise to an authentic tradition or body of stories of the teaching and deeds of Jesus. That worked as long as the apostles were alive. That informal process was perfectly adequate, completely adequate, as long as they were still around. Because part of the self-monitoring process is that if a spurious story started to be rumored about in a certain part of the Roman Empire, somebody could write a letter to an apostle or send, you know, next time they saw an apostle could say, somebody told us this happened. Was that true? And the apostle could simply say, no, that's not true. And that's the end of it. That establishes it, that it excludes it from the tradition. It excludes it from the body of that information that we, the first generation believers, accept as an authentic part of the record of Jesus' teaching and deeds. This informal process has already preceded Luke's recording this gospel, this chronicle, and it has preceded the other written documents that Luke is relying upon. So Luke is not an investigative reporter in the sense that he takes the skeptical stand. I don't know what really happened. I'm not going to believe anybody's account of what really happened. I'm going to go out there and talk to the people and investigate closely for myself what exactly went down in every situation. No way could Luke have done that. I mean, he's far too removed from the events that he's recording that he could actually be an investigative reporter to establish for himself from eyewitness accounts what happened. But he doesn't purport to be doing that. That's not his goal. That's not his agenda. That was the agenda. That was the project of the apostles themselves, because they just were the eyewitnesses to most of the things that we're talking about here. Not all of them, but most of them. And that which they could not be and were not eyewitnesses to, they were in a position to be able to judge the authenticity of those other accounts. So the apostles have been the ones to investigate the truth, the accuracy, the reliability of all this body of information that Luke is going to pass on to us. Luke sees his goal as simply to investigating, when he talks about his investigation, to simply investigate what is really genuinely accepted as part of the apostolic tradition and what is not. Now, he wouldn't be doing that if we weren't beginning to see the intrusion of spurious and false accounts. So even as early as Luke, people are beginning to make up stories, I think. And Luke recognizes that there needs to be a distinction made between what Jesus actually said and what Jesus actually did, and other things that he has purported to have said and have purported to have done. Just on an aside, it seems to me that, I mean, it's ironic that the Roman Catholic Church, for example, and others would take this stand as well, would establish these things officially, would establish the authenticity of these stories through a church council or a papal bull or, you know, some sort of official act and official announcement. What Luke is describing here was completely spontaneous, completely organic, and completely informal. It's people relating to people. We're not playing church. We're not playing Christian politics in establishing the truth of the gospel. It's an organic process where the truth is established by eyewitnesses who have been inspired by the Spirit of truth, the Holy Spirit, in the clarity of their understanding and the clarity of their grasp. So I just think it's interesting that you don't have any support for official ecclesiastical authority here in the very preface of this book. And quite the contrary, you have a very different picture painted. Okay, then if I'm right in my translation, and I'm fairly confident that reliable is the right way to translate that, remember, it occurred to me, having investigated everything carefully from the start, to write it down for you in sequence, most excellent God lover, so that you might know the reliability of the stories you were told. Okay, that's Luke's agenda. I want you to understand the reliability, which was first established by the informal process that I just described under the oversight of the apostles. What does he mean by reliable here? I think it's important to come to terms with that. What Luke is concerned about is our account factual? And what I mean by factual is, did it really happen? You know, did an angel really appear? Did water really turn to wine? Did Jesus really walk on the water? Are these things grounded in objective reality, in that these events actually occurred? So he's concerned about the facticity of these accounts. And probably just as important, he's concerned about the meaning of each and every one of these events. I mean, there's really two ways that you can get the apostolic tradition wrong, both of which would be ultimately destructive. One is, you can make up things that didn't actually happen. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But the other thing is, even if you're talking about things that actually did happen, or at least have a seed of truth and objective reality, you can misconstrue the significance of those events. You can turn them into events that say something vastly and radically different than what they actually mean. And you can end up with a different gospel, a different theology, a different Jesus, a different God in the process. And Luke is very concerned that these events allow to be told in such a way that their meaning reveals their real significance, not some made-up falsified significance that some false teacher might give to them later. So his concern is that these accounts be reliable in that they point us to what really happened and point us to what those things really mean, so that we can know the truth that was revealed by Jesus, the light coming into the world, to get rid of our ignorance and bring us into wisdom instead. Notice though what it doesn't mean, and I think this is important as well. Luke is not after the exact truth as an anal retentive investigator. He's not claiming precision. He's not claiming here that when he gives you a speech by an angel or by Mary or by Zacharias or by, for that matter, Jesus, he's not claiming that this was what was said verbatim. And that's important because a lot of people looking at the gospel account say, "Now, give me a break. You know, there were no tape recorders. Now, how can he have a verbatim account of what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount, or what a verbatim account of what the angel said to Mary, or what Mary said back to the angel? I mean, we don't know." Well, first of all, it's striking and it's interesting that of course it's not verbatim, because undoubtedly the angel spoke to Mary in Aramaic and Luke writes it in Greek. So obviously it's not verbatim, because at the very least it's translated, right? So we don't just have a transcription of some tape recording here. What Luke is concerned about is in the memory of the people who are part of these events, is this the substance of what God said to them, or is it not the substance of what God said to them? And the claim that Luke is making is this is the substance of what God said to them. So we're not talking about precision. We're not talking about verbatim recordings of their deeds. We're not talking about making sure that all the details that could have been there are there, because that's only important if you're curious about trivial, unimportant details. Luke is not writing this to satisfy our curiosity that we might have about relatively trivial and unimportant details. He's writing these things so that we can have a reliable account to base our faith upon. And that's a different agenda. That's a different agenda than just answering all of our curiosities. That's not his goal. Okay, let's move on to Theophilus here. Most commentators probably disagree with me on this. They tend to think that Theophilus is either one of two things, either a wealthy patron who may be financing Luke's this project of creating this chronicle, and it was commonplace, if you did have a wealthy patron who was subsidizing you and financing your project, that you would dedicate it to them. So that's a very real possibility, and I don't discount that. The fact that the title, Most Excellent Theophilus, is the typical standard title that you would give to a high-ranking government official has suggested to many that Theophilus is that. He's a government official who maybe has just converted or is still a pagan but is interested in the Christian faith, and Luke is setting out to write an account for him, for his consideration. That's a possibility, a very real possibility. Theophilus was a name, a real name that people had. We have records of that beginning in about the 3rd century BC. You can find people named Theophilus, so that's certainly a very real possibility that we're dealing with an individual. My preference, however, is to see this as a title where he means it literally, either lover of God or friend of God or something like that. The reason I say that is because let's take one of these other scenarios where it's a high-ranking government official or a wealthy patron. If his concern is exclusively and solely and particularly for that individual, it's an incredibly inefficient and non-economical way of presenting the gospel to an individual to write them an account. I mean, why does Paul not do that? If Paul wants to give you the gospel, he teaches you day and night in the synagogue or in the building next door to the synagogue when you get kicked out of the synagogue. I mean, he just sets up shop somewhere and he teaches and he teaches and he teaches and he presents the tradition that has been well established. Far more efficient than to set out to write an account. The writing of the account suggests to me that Luke recognizes he's not writing this for any living, breathing individuals in front of him with respect to whom it would be more efficient to just talk to him. He's writing this for posterity, for a second and third generation downstream, people that he can't talk to directly because he's going to be gone and dead before he has an opportunity to do so. That's the whole function of this gospel. He tells us so, essentially, as far as I can tell. So Theophilus, therefore, has to be just sort of a representative, somebody, a placeholder for whoever it is that this gospel is serving this purpose for. And it is striking that the name then, Theophilus, lover of God, is the name that he chose, because who better to serve with this than someone whose heart really is a heart that loves God and wants to know his truth, wants to obey him, and wants to embrace God's promises. So it's so strikingly inappropriate a phrase that I have to think this is a literary device that Luke is using. He's not unaware of the fact that to call him most excellent Theophilus mimics the way that you would address a patron or a government official. Yeah, I mean, obviously he's aware of that. But I think he's simply mimicking that language in order to address whoever that reader might be. If I'm right about that, that's a pretty profound thing that he's doing. Because to call you and me or some ordinary street sweeper in Antioch in coming generations most excellent Theophilus is capturing a profound truth that James makes explicit in his letter. Remember in the opening of James where he has that discussion about how the rich man is really deprived and the man of deprivation is really exalted. The low who know the truth of the gospel are really indeed most excellent. And those who we reserve the title most excellent for are really, in fact, the most deprived people who don't know the gospel, who don't know the truth, are really very, very deprived people. And that I would take it is what Luke is doing, if in fact this is just a placeholder for the lover of God, who's the reader, is he's reminding us how high and exalted our position is. We are indeed people of nobility. We are indeed people of dignity. We are indeed people of status. We have, out of all the people in the history of the human race, have been called out, culled out by God to this unique and blessed destiny to be citizens in the kingdom of God one day. Out of the sea of humanity, most of which, as we all tragically have to realize and as we all object to at one level or another, most of which are going to their destruction, are going to be wasted existence, wasted lives. And out of all of this waste of humanity, God is nonetheless choosing out for himself a people who will be citizens of his kingdom for all of eternity. That status is indeed exalted. We are indeed most excellent lovers of God. I mean, it's not really hyperbole for him to say that. It's capturing a really profound truth, I think. Okay. Let me discuss briefly here, what's the importance that Luke places, or what is this importance that Luke places on the reliability of the accounts of Jesus' deeds and teaching? What's behind that? Because I think recognizing what's behind that is important to understanding our faith. To do that, I need to make a distinction Religious people of religious persuasion, can take two different stances toward a fact claim. Now, I hope you know what I mean by a fact claim. That's the philosopher in me, I guess. A fact claim is any sort of assertion that somebody would make about something being factually true. So someone comes along and says, Jesus walked on the water. That's a fact claim. Jesus raised from the dead. That's a claim, a fact claim. Jesus did that. Jesus did that. And we make fact claims all the times in our lives about, we say, this is so, this is the case, this happened, this didn't happen. Those are fact claims. We as religious believers are having to confront various fact claims all the time. My religious persuasion, I can react to those fact claims in one of two ways. I can be ideologically receptive to a fact claim, or I can be rationally receptive to a fact claim. And let me define the difference there. If I'm ideologically receptive to a fact claim, what it means is I have my religious commitment already in place for whatever reasons. It's firmly in place. I am what I am. I am a Christian. I ain't not going to be a Christian. I just am a Christian, period. Or I am a Muslim, I just am a Muslim, I like being a Muslim, I'm not going to change my mind, I'm just a Muslim, period. I mean, you can be committed to a religious perspective and a religious persuasion just because you are. That is your ideology, if you will. If you are ideologically receptive to a fact claim, then you accept the fact claim merely because it is at least coherent with and probably somehow supportive of and reinforcing of your ideology, your religious ideology. Let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about. It evidently, according to some newspaper reports that I've heard, is evidently quite common for the Palestinian, the Muslims in Palestine, to believe, to accept the fact that the Jews make a practice of drinking the blood of Christian babies. So someone has made this fact claim to them, and they wholeheartedly, wholesale, embrace it. Why? Because in their mind, that just helps support the fact that the Jews are pigs. They're evil, satanic pigs. And there you go. That makes perfectly good sense to me, that they drink the blood of Christian babies, because they're just satanic pigs anyway. Well, Did they accept that claim because it makes sense to accept that claim? I mean, is there evidence? Has anyone ever seen it? Do they really think it's plausible that they could get away with that? I mean, you don't have any crying Christian mothers and fathers complaining about the Jews drinking the blood of their babies. Isn't that a fairly obvious omission, if this is a plausible claim. So they don't believe it because there's a rational basis for them to believe it. They believe it because ideologically it fits what they want to believe. We as Christians are tempted at times to receive fact claims because we are ideologically receptive to them. I accept it as true. Why? Because it just fits. It helps support what I want to believe, and I want to believe it, and I need all the help I can get to fortify my belief, so I'm going to believe that. Do you have a rational basis for believing it? No. But I believe it anyway, by faith. We're going to be tempted to do that. But what I'm going to argue here is that that's not where Luke is coming from. A rational receptivity, in contrast, is one where we just use our ordinary common sense and our ordinary rationality and our ordinary sense of proportion of evidence and weight of evidence in order to believe what ought to be believed based on the evidence and whatever's before me. That would be a rational receptivity to it. Luke, I would argue, in the background of what he's saying here, is that he simply assumes that the Christian faith is of such a nature that we ought to be rationally receptive to the facts of the gospel. The difference between an ideological receptivity and a rational receptivity is an ideological receptivity is vulnerable to contrary facts. If contrary facts come along, then your commitment to the truth of your ideology, your religion, is undermined. Sorry, did I say that right? Is not undermined. I'm talking about ideological receptivity. In ideological receptivity, it is not immune to contrary facts. Someone can come along and trot out a whole lot of reasons why it doesn't make any sense for me to believe that, and it doesn't make any difference to me. I didn't believe it because it was reasonable to start with, so showing me that it's unreasonable is not going to make me disbelieve it. I believe it because I want to believe it. There's psychological, emotional, social reasons, cultural reasons for believing it, not rational reasons for believing it. Rational receptivity, on the other hand, is extremely vulnerable to contrary fact claims. If someone comes along and shows me that Jesus didn't walk on the water, Jesus didn't raise from the dead, look, I've got his dog tag here, and I found it in a tomb in Israel, and here's his social security card. None of that stuff would, I mean, all of that stuff becomes potentially a reason not to accept any of it. Because it's not true. Because it's not grounded in history. It's not grounded on the facts. Luke, I would argue, is assuming in this account, in his language about, I want you to know the reliability of the things that have been told to you, Luke is assuming that the facts matter. So he's approaching these facts under the assumption that we need to be rationally receptive of them or reject them on rational grounds. And he wants us to know that they are reliable. They can support your existential commitment to the truth of the gospel because you have a rational basis for knowing that they really happened, that they're really true. Okay, I'm going to run out of time. So let me jump to some prematurely to some conclusions here, and I'll just have to pick this up in 2 weeks. We have the Christmas thing next week, and then we'll pick it up the week after that. And I'll kind of review and add some new information here too. But let me jump to what does this have to do with us? Especially here in the Christmas season, I think it's important to recognize when we celebrate Christmas, we're not celebrating Christmas because it's emotionally satisfying, because it's psychologically satisfying, because it's socially and culturally satisfying. I mean, some people do. But those of us who are biblical Christians in the tradition of Luke, that's not why Christmas is important to us. The reason Christmas is important to us is because it really happened. It really happened that the shepherds heard from the angels. It really happened that Zacharias and Mary heard from angels. It really happened that Mary, being a virgin, bore a child nonetheless, just as the angel had promised. This stuff is important to us because it's grounded in the objective facts and the objective reality of history. It really happened. And furthermore, not only did it really happen, but it was not just cool. It actually was fraught with incredible significance about who God is, what his purposes were, what his promises were, and how we are to relate to those purposes and those promises. It really did mean what the apostles understood that it meant. That's why it's important to us. And as I will talk about in a couple of weeks some more, it's so important that we come then to recognize that the faith that we hold is ultimately, utterly, and completely a rational faith, a faith committed to the reality of these things that we believe. If it is not that, it's something entirely different. It's just an ideology. It's just a culture that we've decided to throw in our lot with. But that's not why I believe, and I trust that's not why you believe. I trust that we would have the kind of faith where we would believe this even if the whole world told us we are crazy. Because reason itself demands it. The evidence itself demands it. Well, we can talk more about that. The problem that I think a lot of us have is that we mistake the psychological reality for the rational reality. I will be the first to admit that this baby being born of a virgin 2,000 or more years ago is very abstract. It's not living and alive and immediate and concrete before me, because no history is concrete to me. All history seems a little abstract. And the future seems even more abstract than the past. So the kingdom of heaven, is it a concrete, palpable reality? No, it seems very, very abstract. And indeed, the way the human mind works, nothing seems palpable and concrete and vivid and dramatic and real to us except the everyday realities that we lay our eyes on. My wife, my children, my house, my dog, my cat, my job, my problems. And those are the concrete, vivid, dramatic, tangible realities that preoccupy us. Those are the things that seem real to us. All this stuff that we confess in our faith, all of it, the most important of it, seems so utterly abstract to us. But we were talking to the Gutenberg students the other day, and Wes said something that it really struck me. We were talking about how Wes was talking about death and how unreal death seems to us, although his point was the older we get, the more real it becomes, the more real it seems. But when we're 20-year-olds, or even 30-year-olds, and if there's no one around us dying, we've heard of death. We've heard that it's universal. We've heard that it's inevitable. But as universal and as inevitable as it is, it still seems abstract to us. It's not the kind of thing that I worry about. It's not the kind of thing that I need to really take into account. But all we have to do is stop and think about it for a second, and you couldn't get anything surer than death. You can't get anything more real than death, the end of our existence now in this present age, even when it seems abstract. It's that same dichotomy that we have to face with respect to the foundational truths of our faith. Psychologically, emotionally, do they appear to us? Do we experience them as abstract? Absolutely. Does that mean they're not real? No way. Absolutely does that not mean that they're not real. Some of the most real things that we know may impact us as abstract. But oh well, so what? I think this is exactly what Paul was talking about in 2 Corinthians when he says, we walk by faith and not by sight. He doesn't mean, and this is what we'll talk about in 2 weeks, he doesn't mean we walk by faith and not by reason, because the apostles don't recognize any distinction between faith and reason, I would argue. Faith is rational, and rationality leads to the commitment that is faith. So there's no dichotomy, there's no conflict between faith and reason. That's not what he's saying. But there is a conflict between the concrete tangibility of what my eyes deliver to me and the abstract, almost ethereal nature of what my mind can sometimes grasp, what my mind grasps. And what Paul is saying is, we as believers have overcome the temptation of simply being preoccupied with the ordinary everyday realities that are so concretely before me, that are delivered through my eyes. We're not preoccupied with that any longer. We become intent on living my life in the light of what I know is true with my mind, even if my eyes don't see it, even if it seems distant and ethereal to me. But nonetheless, what I do, what I say, what I think, what I choose, how I behave, becomes governed by what I know to be true, rather than what appears immediate and urgent to me. And that I think is what he means by we walk by faith and not by sight. I will stop there and let you have a crack at me.
You know, Jack, I find it ironic that I think I speak for the vast majority in here. We're Christians because of something beyond irrationality, something that touched us existentially something that moved us in a way that our rationality didn't bring us there. And yet, we are always encouraged to use our rationality to keep us anchored in what initially wasn't rationality in the first place. And there's a temptation, at least on my part, and it's an arrogance, to judge everything else around me in a rational format, as if rationality is what delivered me to where I'm at and gave me the eyes to judge everything else. There, I just find it just an irony.
Well, I won't let you off the hook if you say you're arrogant. You're arrogant. But let me say, though, that I do think that my just simply being critical, rationally critical, in and of itself is not arrogance. Because I think this is the tool that God gave us to keep us on track with what's true. I don't think it's inappropriate for us to be critical-minded and rational in our critiquing the claims and the ideas and the beliefs of other people. I think that's what we're supposed to do. I think we ought to do it. Now, we can do that arrogantly, or we can do that with humility, and that's another issue. But I don't think the fact that we are doing that and using our reason is in and of itself arrogant. But I'll talk more about this in a couple weeks, but I just decided. But it's important that we not too narrowly define rationality. One of the most helpful things that I ever did, one of the books we have in our curriculum at Gutenberg is a book by Michael Polanyi called Personal Knowledge. And Personal Knowledge was a very, very important book to me, because in that book he explores, he's primarily a scientist, and he's exploring the role of reason in the scientific pursuit. And you are struck by the mystery of rationality in that book. How all-inclusive it is, how comprehensive it is, how mysterious it is, how not capable of being subjected to rules and laws it is. How he calls it ineffable. You can't really ultimately describe what it is and how it works. It just does. And so when I talk about reason in the spirit of Michael Polanyi, I have a much bigger, grander, fuller concept of what rationality is than maybe we're accustomed to using the word. I don't mean this kind of narrow, truncated, give me an argument, and then I can believe. Because you're absolutely right. There was so much more that went into our commitment to the truth of the gospel than an argument somewhere. And who of us were convicted? Who of us converted because of an argument? It's far more important and inclusive and all comprehensive than that. An argument is not enough. So, but I would argue, but what we were responding to, when we responded to the gospel, we were rational beings responding rationally to a rational appeal. No, we didn't.
No, I certainly agree with you as far as rationality is concerned. It's much more than just steps of logic. It's ineffable is a great term for that. But I don't think it's a response. I don't think it's so much a response to logic as it is a lot of times an emotional. And then even the term emotion, what in the world does that mean? Can you right. splice it apart from rationality? I don't think so.
Right, I agree. Well, when I get around to finally defining it in 2 weeks, I mean, there is a difference between faith and reason, I think. And that is that faith incorporates and is fully rational on the one hand, but it's not merely rational. It's not only rational. And the term that I like the best to describe what it is in addition to being rational is it is existential. And what I mean by that is it's deeply personal. It's an investment of my entire being and my entire existence in the truth of what reason tells me is the truth. And somebody can rationally come to recognize the truth of the gospel but never commit to it. never make that existential commitment. They're not believers in the biblical sense. And so I would certainly agree to that degree that it's not rational, or certainly not exhausted by rationality, what it is that we're into. That existential decision is ultimately a gift from God, a miracle that is not reducible to mere rationality. I certainly agree with that.
Briefly, could you comment on the differences between Luke's, which you referred to as his preface, and John's, what's often called the prologue? They're such of different character. Could you make a few comments about that?
Yeah, John's is sweeping in vision, is cosmic in vision. He's sort of encapsulating the whole gospel in a few sentences there, going from the beginning of the creation of the cosmos to down to the coming of Jesus into the world and the relationship between the two and the significance. And it's just spine-tingling to me. I mean, his prologue is just amazing. What Luke is doing is telling you about this project. I mean, his preface is a preface to the project, not a prologue to the gospel, a theological prologue to the gospel, but a literary preface to his literary project. Why am I doing what I'm doing, and what's going on here? And both in their own way are vital to us. I mean, it's just a preface, but hidden within this preface for Luke is a whole epistemology. He doesn't make it explicit, but he wouldn't be doing what he was doing if he didn't have a particular view of the relationship between evidence and our existential commitment of faith. And recognizing what he thinks is the relationship between evidence and our existential commitment is a religious epistemology that we need to come to terms with. I mean, do we accept that or not? And I think it's a wonderful religious epistemology.
I'm kind of along with what you just said, and also kind of taking off from what Kurt was saying. It is hard, I think, for us, particularly maybe in our training and what rationality is and supposed to look like, and the history that we've had with that word, that concept coming out of like the Enlightenment and all that stuff. But even backing up and saying, no, rationality is actually very complex. It's very big. It's very huge. It's very mysterious. It seems that when we come to the gospel, that there is a rationality that is receptive to the gospel, and there is a rationality that is not receptive to the gospel. And that for a person to go from being someone who has a rationality that is not receptive and has no interest in the truth claims of the gospel, to being a person that has a rationality that is receptive to it, that there's something remarkably profound, that I'm now stepping beyond looking at, well, you know, me, in a sense, what have I done, you know, what work have I done, what work have other people done to come to me to kind of lay things out, what, you know, even my own life experience and stuff. There's something that seems to transcend that and really calls upon, you know, something mysterious has happened, which we would say is the work of the Holy Spirit coming. What are we still on? Okay. Actually changing me in a profound way. And at that point, there's something that seems very mysterious and very, very huge that has happened to me that is beyond my rationality in a sense. I mean, it's something coming from outside God's work. And that when Luke talks about, you know, uses the phrase Theophilus or lover of God, that in a sense he's saying, I'm writing this to you, reader, who has had that rationality in you change to be receptive to these kinds of things I'm going to lay out for you, even though what his project is at the same time is to be very rational in a factual sense and in a meaning sense. There's a recognition that someone who hasn't had that profound change, this book is going to be relatively meaningless to them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to call it beyond rationality is fine, as long as the problem is when most people talk about being beyond rational, what they mean is another way of knowing that is other than and different than rationality. And that's the thing that I am resisting, is that it's not beyond rational in that sense. It's supernatural. That is, it's we would be allergic to the truth if the Spirit of God did not invade my being and give me what you described as that receptivity to it that is not otherwise there. And we remove the allergy, remove the hostility, remove the resistance that's naturally within me so that I can be receptive rationally. I forgot the main point of what I was going to say in response. I think here's where I'm coming from. The thing, some people take the position that because the Spirit of God can invade my being and can transform me and bring me to belief, then rationality becomes irrelevant. Because, look, I believe. Damn the facts, I believe. But that's precisely not what Luke is saying. Luke is, as I think you rightly point out, expecting that his readers are people who have been affected by the Spirit of God, and having been affected by the Spirit of God, they are receptive to it. So he says, I want to lay out for you the facts that are reliable. Well, if this is just ideological, if the Spirit of God only invades my being to turn me into a Christian ideologue, then why are facts relevant? Who cares whether the facts are reliable or not? But to Luke, he does. To Luke, they're crucial. Because the work of the Spirit of God is to turn me into someone who can, by the evidence, embrace the truth, not to turn me into someone who no longer cares about evidence because I'm going to believe anyway. Those are radically different conceptions of the Spirit of God. And yeah, you're right. He's writing to people who are receptive, but they are receptive to the evidence as rational evidence, I think. And that's what he wants to lay out for them. Okay, I need to let you go. We'll pick this up in 2 weeks.